You got the touch. You got the power.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Transformers the Movie. Watching it with me is Paul Abbott. Hi Paul, how are you?
I'm fine, it's nice to be here.
Thank you for bringing your battered Betamax copy of the movie. Now, we planned this ages ago, and this was the first film that you mentioned. What's so special about this one for you?
This is a film that probably out of everything I've ever watched or seen in my life, in any format, TV, film, that has stuck with me since first seeing it. And I didn't see it in the cinema, saw it on cassette first in the 80s, so probably about 86, 87 when it first came out on home video or whatever. And it's just never left me. It's never gone away. My love for it has never diminished. There was a few years I stepped away from it, you know, when I was being a teenager and doing all that boring stuff. But I don't know, it just got its claws in very early days. I was obsessed with Transformers when I was a kid. Yeah. You know, in school, when you're like in primary and junior school, and you'd have, well, I suppose they were English classes, not that you had went off for different classes and stuff, but you'd be writing stories and things like that. Mm. I would always just write about Transformers all the time. I would write Transformers stories until one of my teachers said, "Paul, can you stop writing stories about Transformers?" And I said, "Yeah, all right." And so I wrote a story about GoBots instead.
far inferior, but not a million miles away.
Yeah, better than not writing about robots.
That is true. Now, I mean, this film, I must admit, I'm in a very similar mind. I mean, I was all about Transformers. Sort of between me and my brother and my cousin, we had pretty much all of the toys, except annoyingly Megatron. And I mean,
it was a rare thing, I think.
It was, and I remember seeing it once in a shop in the place in Scotland where my dad's from, and they had it in the Woolworths there. And this would have been 1987, 88, and it was 50 quid. And of course, they didn't buy it for me, and obviously with the benefit of hindsight now, I don't blame them. I mean, I saw this film, and I know this film caused quite a lot of issues when it came out. Now, it was set between series 2 and 3 of the cartoons, or the yeah, TV show, and I guess sort of back then I didn't really have any concept of sort of series or seasons, but again, like yourself, I didn't get to see this at the cinema, but when I saw it on video, I was like, what? Now, massive spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this, we're going to talk about a lot of people dying. Oh, I say people, but
they're people to us.
They are, they're I want to say father figures, but when I...
Well, at least one father figure.
And when I was, 7 or 8 when I saw this, and seeing Optimus Prime dying half an hour into Transformers the movie, my God, there were tears.
Yeah, and I still... It's stupid. As a 40-year-old man, having watched this probably hundreds of times, knowing the stuff's going to happen, knowing what's coming up, being able to more or less quote along exactly, it still gets me, that scene. But, well, perhaps save our discussion of that till we get there, but even just thinking about it, a dagger in my heart.
Yes. It's easy to look at it now and look at the cast of this film. Now, even, you know, when the credits roll, it is a very eclectic mix, but it's still, you know, you never thought you'd see Orson Welles, Eric Idle, Leonard Nimoy and Judd Nelson in the same film. But
together at last.
Brought together in the battle of all battles. I don't think I knew who Orson Welles was at the time, but I suppose this must make this now a serious film podcast, finally.
Oh, definitely. I mean, if Orson's involved, I mean, he didn't do anything ridiculous in his later years of life or anything.
No. And bear in mind, this was his final film. I guess this is some legacy to bow out on.
I get the feeling that from what I know of Orson's later years, he was alternately sort of all right with doing this and dismissive of doing this when people talk to him. But given that he'd spent most of the last few years directing like low quality adverts for British TV, his star wasn't quite in the position it once was in the firmament. He did the Hofmeister Bear adverts.
Legend.
Which you just... It's almost impossible to reconcile with the idea of the man that made Citizen Kane is that he did the Follow the Bear Hofmeister adverts.
Yeah, but I bet more people have seen the Hofmeister Bear adverts than have seen Citizen Kane.
Probably, yeah. Probably. They'll last longer.
I'm showing my cultural insignificance here. Now, Orson Welles played a planet, yes, called Unicron, who destroys, devours, eats, whatever you call it, other planets. Now, this was meant to be a different sort of line down the film. He ended up at one point transforming into essentially a giant transformer robot anyway. But the idea of a planet destroying other planets is very, I suppose, it's the sort of sci-fi that you would put beyond a simple cartoon that aims to sell toys. We kind of talked about this on the sort of Masters of the Universe and, to a lesser extent, the Garbage Pail Kids. God. But, you know, this film is essentially, it's mutated from a glorified advert into, you know, what we're talking about 33 years later. It's really made its mark.
It's insane, given that at the time, and if you look at any of the reviews from the time, they're almost all universally horrible. They hate it. They just say it's a big toy commercial. That's all the reviewers say. It's a big toy commercial. And fundamentally, all of those cartoons were. This is where, they started with the toys, then did the cartoons. It wasn't the other way around. Mm. Same for Thundercats and He-Man and She-Ra and everything. That's fair enough. But things are allowed to take on a little bit of a further life once creative people get involved in it. And I think the great thing about Transformers the movie is it's the perfect storm of people writing, the animation studio stepping up their game a bit, the cast coming in and doing an amazing job, and the voice director being really, really good. So there's a reason I think it's cult as much as things 40-year-old men like are, but there's a reason for that, and it's, you know, there's a reason we're not watching the GoBots movie in 2019. Because that was proper shite, to coin a phrase.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, you look at the filmography of the director, and his biggest ever credit was the My Little Pony movie. He's clearly an expert in a very narrow field.
Yeah, but they were experts in their field. They were, you know, and probably anyone around our ages would have known. Well, they wouldn't have known that they were hearing the work of all of these people, loads of these voice actors and directors and animators and things like that. But it was the mainstay of what we were watching. Certainly, stuff that came from America or America, Japan, whatever.
And it's funny as well the way that the film served as a purpose of moving the generation of toys. So it was the end of the Optimus Prime, Megatron, that era, and bringing in the second generation, which I obviously don't really remember this too well, but by all accounts didn't last for too long, because the uproar of Optimus Prime and that dying in this film, they came back to life within, I think, about 9 months.
Yeah. In fact, I think by the time I saw this film on the version that was released in the UK and in Europe, it was slightly different to the one that's available now, in that it had a voiceover at the end saying, you know, summing up what had happened in that sort of powerful voiceover tones that they have for those things, and saying, and the greatest Autobot of all will return. So even by the time it's got onto home video, they're going, don't worry, he'll be back.
I did like the fact that on the TV adverts that they had on the disc, they were promoting it as starring Leonard Nimoy and Judd Nelson.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And obviously Leonard Nimoy, fantastic voice. And he gets a really good role in this. And Judd Nelson, if you were, 6 to 8 years old in 1986, you wouldn't have a clue who Judd Nelson was. You might have actually seen Leonard Nimoy on TV because of Star Trek, which you could be plonked in front of at any age, really. But who would know who Judd Nelson was? You wouldn't see that at 8 years old going, oh, brilliant, Judd Nelson.
And even then, having recently seen The Breakfast Club for doing it for one of the previous episodes of the pod, you know, he was a 25-year-old playing a 16-year-old. It wouldn't seem your logical choice for the supposed next leader of the Autobots.
No, indeed. But at this point, I'd like to make a confession, and that is, until the other day, the day before I rewatched Transformers the movie, I'd never seen The Breakfast Club. And I made a point of watching it, because we've got it on DVD, and I said to my partner, who I've been with for 17 years, and I said, "I've not. Can we watch The Breakfast Club? Because I've never seen it, and Judd Nelson's in it." And I got the shocked face that happens when you tell people you've not seen The Breakfast Club. So at least I've seen that now, and know what all those cliches and references are as well.
You can put two and two together. You can put a face to the Hot Rod name.
Yeah, that's it.
Now, one thing that did come up, another thing from previous episodes. Now, the score for this film was by Vince Dicola, who did the, I suppose, iconic score to Rocky IV.
Yeah.
There were a lot of similarities between the two, I suppose. They only came out a year apart. But the sort of music, the ominous Unicron's approaching was very much like the theme of Ivan Drago. And, I mean, whenever I mention this film on Twitter or Facebook, people always come back with the Touch song, the one that everyone remembers. And even hearing it this time round, you know, on my big telly, you still get that tingle that first time you hear it, even though it got, I wouldn't say tainted by Boogie Nights, but it certainly got ripped off.
Yeah, it's a shame when people only know it from that, really, because the soundtrack for this is amazing. I mean, the soundtrack, in its pure sense, the Vince Dicola stuff, is amazing, and he got the gig off the back of Rocky IV, I think, because they wanted that sound. He did it all synthy. And then there's all these songs, of which The Touch and Dare, which are written and then performed by Stan Bush, are just amazing examples of music of the time, and they fit so well into the film. And then there's a good handful of other hard rock metal songs in there, and a little spot of Weird Al as well.
Yeah, that was odd, but I'm not going to say no to a bit of Weird Al.
No.
I'm sure when we ever get around to doing the UHF episode.
Yeah, oh, it's such a good film. When me and my brother used to watch Transformers the movie all the time, the Weird Al song's called Dare to Be Stupid, but we just didn't know what it was. We couldn't make out the lyrics at all. And, you know, we never looked at the credits where it actually said the name of the song at the end. And so we just used to call it Denneby Doobie. Just so for years it was like, oh, I remember that song, Denneby Doobie.
To be fair, I think around that time, before we'd seen UHF, we only knew me and my brother, who was a couple of years younger, we only knew Weird Al Yankovic for the Eat It song.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, magical times. Mm-hmm. This film, whenever people talk about Transformers films, it's easy to get misled down the line of the recent-ish live-action ones. Mm. I think there have been, is it five plus the Bumblebee one?
Yeah.
Now, have you seen Bumblebee?
I have been to see Bumblebee. My brother and I, in classic tradition, my brother is similarly, he's a couple of years younger than me, 3 years younger than me, and went to see it together over Christmas. And it was brilliant. It was really, really good.
Blimey.
But you don't need any of the other five Michael Bay directed ones, because they are awful, racist, sexist, difficult to watch, damaging to the legacy if you want to be uptight about it. Whereas Bumblebee actually did exactly what it's supposed to do. It aimed for a younger audience, more of a female skewed demographic, and it really, really works for that purpose. It treats the human characters well, treats the robot characters well, gives you loads of Cybertron looking Generation 1 designs and things, and so it's like, yes, that was great. I'm happy with that. Ignore all the other ones.
I'll have to go and I have to make a point of seeing that. I mean, I don't get to the cinema that often these days, but I remember, I think one of the more recent visits was my friend insisted we go and see the last main one. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the one with Anthony Hopkins in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I came out just on the verge of tears for not the same reasons that when I saw Transformers the movie. I mean, I remember the first one being all right.
Yeah, it was because it was a new thing as well, and it was quite something to see how they'd done it. And Optimus Prime, obviously, once he's got Peter Cullen doing the voice, that lends an air of legitimacy to the notion of it, because if without that voice, it's Prime's not really anything. But they just got worse and worse and worse, and more incomprehensible as well.
It was just a big headache for 2 hours, and I suppose funny that we were talking about Boogie Nights and Dirk Diggler, and then Mark Wahlberg pops up.
Yeah.
But Yes. Going back to this film, I mean, the story itself, it is, you know, for want of anything else, it's quite straightforward. It could be 3 or 4 episodes of the TV show stitched together. I remember I did have on video, I think it was called Escape from Cybertron, and it yes. turned out, when I looked into it a few years ago, it was actually just the first 3 episodes of the TV series sort of stitched into one.
It was, yes. I had that tape, wore that one out.
I mean, I suppose it's the same thing. I always remember, oh yeah, the movie of Street Hawk. Nope, it's just the first episode. But this one, you know, and even talked to my mate about it, you know, I say Transformers the movie, and he was, oh yeah, Arrival from Cybertron, that was the one.
Yeah.
And we found them on YouTube, and it definitely wasn't. But there is an element of expecting people to have seen the TV show before you see the film. You know, there's no huge introduction into the Autobots, the Decepticons. I mean, it's quite obvious who are the yeah. goodies, who are the baddies. But, you know, it doesn't take long to go straight into the action. There isn't a huge amount of build-up.
There's not much flab on the film. It's, you know, it's an action-adventure that lasts, what, 88 minutes or something like that, which is, you know, kids' film length, and really most films would benefit from being 88 minutes. But I think it is so simple that you can't do much to say the baddies are the ones who within 5 minutes are shooting at everyone and killing them. The goodies are the ones trying to rescue each other and stuff like that. It's pretty obvious.
I remember being a little bit shocked by the opening part where Megatron bursts into the shuttle that's heading off, and he shoots, I can't remember the name of one of the Autobots, and fire starts coming out of his eyes.
Prowl. Yeah, he kills Prowl, one of the first wave.
And I remember seeing that, just thinking, bloody hell, like fire coming out of his eyes, that's pretty special.
Well, yeah, it wasn't just that they killed off the characters, they killed some of them in really quite spectacularly gory ways as well. Either heartbreaking or gory.
Yeah, and yes, you know, a fair few of them did come back in various guises, although, you know, there have been so many, like, you know, Star Wars or whatever, they come back in various other sort of spin-offs or cartoons that then are canon.
Yes.
You know, and all of a sudden, because I remember reading about the token female character in this, RC, who's obviously yeah. pink, and because, was it one of the main writers or the director, his daughter was really into Transformers, even though they were obviously marketed to boys, and they managed to get a female character in, but even then her toy wasn't released for quite some time afterwards.
In fact, probably not until a few years ago now, about 10
quite recently,
years ago or something.
Yeah.
But fortunately, what that did was that sparked a bit of a change in the sort of the fan legacy, which has become the mainstream legacy. And there's loads of female Transformers now, and some of them are actually the main characters in the current stories that exist in the comics and all the things, of which there's so many I can't keep track of. But there's like one called Windblade, who's a really major character now, who's really, really cool. And it's a shame it wasn't, RC's role wasn't a bit more than, I don't know, I always thought she was really cool in that, though. I thought it was really cool to have a female Transformer in there and sort of be a bit kick-ass when needed. And she didn't really, I mean, she was rescued a couple of times, but she didn't really take any guff from anyone.
No. I suppose this film was set in 2005, so already yeah. in the past.
Yeah, we'd all be wearing those white jumpsuits that all the humans are wearing.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, it'd be all right, wouldn't it?
I guess Autobot City is, I suppose, that they've colonised part of, well, from the look at the map, part of the USA, which
yeah.
I suppose these days wouldn't be tolerated. But it's this huge sort of iconic structure that, you know, takes up, and it's a very scenic part as well, all around lakes where Hot Rod and, what's the kid's name, Daniel,
yeah,
go
Daniel.
Fishing and... It's that now. It's all. It's quite amusing when you look at it, especially this film that always looked to be in the future, and we've fully dated it in 2005. When, yeah,
yeah. People's future visions were always very sort of like, I can't imagine it being 10 years from now or 20 years from now, and then suddenly it is 30 years from now, and you're going, what? Hang on, what? Why didn't you just say 2050 or 21, you know, 100 or whatever years are in the future?
Well, this is the funny thing. I mean, we're recording this in 2019, and it's quite a big thing that this is the year that Blade Runner was set in.
Yes.
And, you know, at the start of the year, say a couple of weeks ago, people were bringing out the various blog posts and articles about, oh, well, they thought the world would look like this when Blade Runner came out. And I think it was also 2019 when the main part of the Running Man happened. And,
yeah,
you know, it's easy to look back and think of, you know, oh, in the future, because some of the films that I've done for this podcast, you know, they've either been set in set times. And I think one of them, the Runaway with Tom Selleck, it was always just set as in the near future. They didn't quite put a date on it. It wasn't as specific as, say, I know, The Terminator, which was set around exact dates. It's still looking, you know, odd, looking back, I suppose, well, 14 years now. It's a bit like the old Back to the Future 2 stuff when that happened.
Yeah, it's. I think it's part of the charm, isn't it? So as you approach and pass the dates of these things, it's an interesting thing to look at and either just sort of have a little wry smile at or think, well, there you go, see, we've got... But the amazing thing is, as well, with a lot of those, is in many ways we've superseded things in technology and the things. No one ever really invents mobile phones in these films, do they? Or the stuff that we've got on us. Also, we don't do a lot of the other stuff like flying cars, etc. Yet.
Entire meals in pill form.
Yeah.
Now, as... So the Decepticons are attacking Autobot City. And one thing I always loved, and I remember... Now, you might be able to help me with this. Soundwave, because he's got his tapes, they start attacking. Did the Soundwave toy play cassettes like an actual thing, or was that just in my head?
No, I believe there was lots of... Was it him basically being a cassette? You know, what do you call it? Boombox type thing.
Hmm.
There was obviously there was a few spin-offs, I think. So I think there was models made that weren't a toy type thing, but they were Soundwave that could play tapes, you know, sort of tie in things. But the actual toy didn't. I never had him. I'm still waiting to try and spend some money to buy Soundwave.
I wonder what they're going for on eBay at the moment.
Yeah, fortunately, I think there's a new one coming out in this new range, so that might only be about £20, which might be a bit more reasonable.
Well, I believe I remember seeing the Soundwave toy in Aliens at one point. That was on... I can't remember. There was definitely a couple of Transformers toys.
Yeah, I think there's like Soundwave and Shockwave or something are on a shelf or something, aren't they? Just in the background of a shot.
I wonder how much they paid for that. That would have been 86 as well, so... But yeah, I mean, so, you know, we've got the main, certainly the first battle anyway, and this is all kicking off. Optimus Prime turns up with the Dinobots, who I loved at the time, and even out of standby. Shut up, dog! so he turns up with the Autobots, and I think even recently, someone I used to work with, he called his dog Grimlock.
Oh, excellent.
And things like that, and I used to love them. And I think I didn't have the toy of Grimlock, but I had one of the other Dinobots.
Yeah.
Because this film launched them, I believe.
Yeah, well, I think this was their first big outing as, you know, as sort of characters rather than sort of comic relief things out of the main cartoon.
Yeah.
I had Sludge, the Brontosaurus type one. He was the only one I had.
That was it.
Must have been common on the British shelves. They have a lot to do in this film, so they're one of the main sort of movers of the action, or sort of people that come in and solve the problems by squashing people.
I suppose if they're new on the scene, they've got to give them plenty of screen time.
Yeah.
What? And now this would be, you'd assume, the sort of main battle of the film: Optimus Prime against Megatron. Now Megatron has a lightsaber,
yes,
which I don't remember from sort of from elsewhere, but again, this seems like it's over quite quickly. I know they don't have a huge amount of one-on-one fights, but it doesn't last for too long, and I think it's only about 26 minutes into the film when this all kicks off. But Optimus Prime dies from his injuries. Shed a tear. And obviously, he gets one final blow in on Megatron, and I suppose I wouldn't say he even fatally wounds him, but he certainly does significant damage to him anyway. But Hot Rod kind of gets in the way, and, you know, in trying to help, because Cub warns him off, and he gets in the way, so Megatron grabs him. And we get this whole horrible death scene for Optimus Prime.
I know, where, they don't give you any sort of any emotional breathing time, really. You get this fight scene, which I think is fantastically animated as well. Mm. That's one of the great things about this, the step up in level of animation from the TV series, because of the money they had to spend and the little bit longer they had to make it is really good. So the fight scene, especially the one-on-one between Optimus Prime and Megatron, is really well choreographed as much as anything, I suppose. But yeah. Then you're straight out of that where you're like, yes, finally Prime's won and he turned the tide. And then you're straight into the I fear the wounds are fatal sequence.
Yeah. And the whole talk about the matrix of leadership, and I know this was one of the plots of one of the films, wasn't it? I can't remember which one. And yeah. I did have an Ultra Magnus toy, and it was basically one of the sort of car transporters. But again, this was something that at the time I always had it in my head that Ultra Magnus was this young, you know, in the hot rod way. He was an up-and-coming... But it was Robert Stack, you know.
Yeah.
Doing the voice, you know, a sort of real pro...
Solid.
You know, he was, you know. And again, I suppose most people probably recognise him from Airplane. But doing, you know, sort of being very reluctant, taking on everything. But, you know, I mean, when Optimus Prime finally dies... You know, he turns grey and it, oh God. Just think of that now. I mean, I only watched the film last night, and even then watching it, it was like, oh, bloody hell.
I mean, this is a character that kids had just taken to their hearts in a massive way over the past couple of years since the toy line had launched. You know, not just in America, but everywhere. It was a huge, you know, phenomenon. And he was the main character, and he was always the sort of cool in a way of like, not hot rod cool, but like just. The one you wanted to have, Optimus Prime. He was so reliable and dependent, and he'd lead people, and he had the right moral core. And then they've killed him off, and they've not just killed him off. They've done the full anime, you know, slow death. He turns grey. In fact, they even have the heart monitor type thing beeping down. Beep, beep. Oh God, it's heartbreaking.
I know, and you know, again, like my cousin had the toy of Optimus Prime, you know, and you know he was these vibrant, you know, this bright red and blue truck with a, you know, and everything about it, and to see, you know, just turning this charcoal grey on this slab, just bloody hell, it's heartbreaking.
But that's just after they've introduced the Matrix of Leadership, and this is I think it's a bit of a big turning point for a lot of cartoons in that they introduce like this. Quasi-religious element in that all this knowledge and history and essence is distilled into an object. And you can, I mean, what do you think about the Star Wars influence on this film? There is tons of it, isn't it? That the Matrix is almost contains the Force or something like that.
It is, because, you know, as he's dying and gives it to Ultra Magnus, and he's saying, you know, this will light up our darkest hour.
Yeah.
And it is, again, like, you know, this, you're our only hope, and the rebellion against the Empire, and this.
This big sort of destiny hanging over everything.
It is. And again, this is somewhat, you know, at the time, I mean, it was only a couple of years after Return of the Jedi, and I suppose Optimus Prime against Megatron would be the equivalent of, well, Luke Skywalker against Darth Vader. You know, and imagine if, and obviously that's where we are now, we have moved on sort of however many years later, but, you know, imagine if they've gone into Return of the Jedi and killed both of them off after half an hour.
They should have done, the cowards.
We were left with Ewoks and God knows what else. But it's strange because, and again, this is something that I know gets explored in some ways in the films, but, you know, the fact that the Matrix of Leadership almost shows that Prime isn't the be-all and end-all. He's just the latest in a long line of leaders. And I suppose it shows that there must have been a long story before him and presumably after him as well. But to concentrate all the power of the Autobots into one glorious medallion.
Yeah, and it is a good medallion, isn't it?
It looks, yeah. I wouldn't mind having that around my neck. It'd probably weigh me down, but...
Yeah,
it's pretty special.
But of course, what happens is it looks a bit like the main baddie, Unicron. It looks like a planet surrounded by a thing. So they're sort of opposite. So this physical little thing that's inside Optimus Prime's chest is the antithesis of the massive planet Unicron. And it's that point in the film at which we get the notion of what's going to happen. Unicron wants the Matrix destroyed, and he can't do it himself for some reason. So he grabs hold of all the discarded Decepticons.
I mean, it shows the, again, not that you need a huge ethics lesson in this film, but the fact that everyone mourns the death of Optimus Prime and all the other characters who die, and yet the Decepticons are struggling to get back to Cybertron. They're thinking, right, those who are dying, kick them out. You know, they're clearly slowing them down.
Yeah.
And Unicron summons Megatron. You know, even Megatron, you know, he's maybe not quite on death's door, but he's certainly, you know, he's never going to be the same again. He's not well. And he summons him and drags him. And even then, he's still putting up the, no one summons me, all that.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite sequences, that, because it's the first time you get to hear Orson Welles in his full, and they're voice modulated as well, so he's even got this, I mean, we know Orson Welles was the size of a planet, but he's had his voice modulated down to make him sound even bigger. And yeah, it's all this stuff where Megatron's sort of going, nobody summons me, and he says one of my favourite lines, which is like, it pleases me to be the first.
I have summoned you here for a purpose.
Nobody summons Megatron.
Then it pleases me to be the first.
And which follows up as well when Megatron doesn't agree with, okay, proceed your way to oblivion.
But I always remember this. I mean, the fact that they've taken, you know, the main villain, and obviously the idea is that they transform him into, basically take him and put him in a new body. But that's a bold one as well. I mean, obviously they've killed off Optimus Prime completely. And with Megatron, they've essentially turned him into a new character, albeit, you know, basically a huge upgrade, and then given him Leonard Nimoy's voice as well.
At least for the movie. When it comes back on the TV series, Leonard Nimoy didn't stick around for that.
He was too busy directing Freeman and a baby.
Oh, yes, well, he would be, wouldn't he? He had other things on his mind. He got to wrangle Gutenberg.
Ah, oh, lucky man. I mean, I remember this scene because my brother had the Galvatron toy. You know, it was much more futuristic, you know, with the various curves. And I had Scourge, one of the sort of minion toys as well. But this is sort of typical, really. You know, they've turned him into this new and improved being with this ultimate mission. You know, so always, and this is what Galvatron, probably keep calling him Megatron, he tries to rebel the whole time, you know, and there's always that voice in his head, you know, whenever he has any sort of mutiny towards Unicron, there's always this sort of crushing screeching in his ear.
And I think they use that then later in later stories to suggest that he's been mad since he was made, and so even though he becomes the leader of the Decepticons, he's absolutely bonkers because Unicron's basically ripped his mind to shreds. Which is a nice character trait to give one of your kids' toys.
Yeah, he's mentally ill because of torture.
Yeah, basically.
I did like the way that they went back to see the coronation of Starscream. And, you know, Starscream's always been this perennial little... Now, I'm not going to... This isn't a clean podcast. Little twat.
Who's been, that's fair enough.
Who's been goads Megatron constantly. I mean, even at the start of this film, he's like, oh, yeah, well done, great plan. You know, and Galvatron turns up and he's just like, right, kill you.
I love Starscream's get-up, though. Starscream finally gets what he wants to become leader of the Decepticons. And he's not going to do it just by sort of signing something. He's having a full ceremony with a bunch of robots playing trumpets. He's got a cape and shoulder pads and a crown.
It's like he's been crowned Pimp of the Year.
Well, he definitely was in that moment. He makes a lovely silhouette when he gets disintegrated as a result of all that gear.
Yeah. What a way to go. So Unicron turns up, and obviously his next mission is to get to Cybertron, and he starts destroying the moon bases that are, say, run by the Autobots, because Bumblebee and Spike are on there, and that's when one of them says shit,
which wasn't in the version I watched as a kid.
Yeah, I think that's the first time I'd ever noticed it.
Yes, it was. I think it was I don't think it ever made it into cinemas, and they just put it back in for the DVD releases, possibly, when basically Spike, who was the original kid in the series, who's now a grown-up, says, oh, shit, what are we going to do now? And it's like, it's one swear word. It's not a particularly violent swear word, but it's quite shocking in context, really. You're thinking this is a kid's cartoon, and they thought, oh, we'll put that in, see if that makes the edit.
I always thought that character was Dennis Quaid for some reason. It maybe just looks like him.
But, it does look a bit like him, you're right.
Yeah. One thing I did read, actually, and I do try and skim the trivia on IMDb, was apparently they were actually looking for a PG rating rather than a whatever the American equivalent of a universal is, because they can get more, it can be played more in cinemas.
Oh, yeah, that's fair enough.
Because I believe they don't show the sort of kids' films after a certain time in the evening, whereas a PG one they will, so technically it could play all day.
I can imagine popping along to the midnight showing of Transformers the movie.
I'd be told off. But then I suppose this would be the, this is the issue now, I suppose, with getting into this discussion. I mean, I've not gone anywhere near yet a Star Wars film, but you look at the issues that a lot of the Star Wars films now are having. I mean, you know, these are guys who have spent 40 years watching Star Wars, and all of a sudden now are they, for various reasons, they don't like it. You know, imagine, you know, at least when Transformers the movie came out, you know, the people, the regulars, the customers, the fans were still kids.
Yes.
So they're not going to, and of course there's no internet to have message boards or Twitter or moan about it, but you know, you can imagine if these were sort of middle-aged men with clearly weird priorities, this would cause some massive issues. But I suppose thankfully back then these weren't problems, but yeah, imagine if they did that now. Oh god, perish the thought. We can just tweet the director and give him death threats. No one will know. It's fine. So the Autobot ship again is attacked. This is one where Ultra Magnus, and they're on a ship that separates. I believe that's quite a common thing in Star Trek. I think I only have very
when they take the top bit of the ship off.
And the Decepticons think he's dead, and he's managed to go to the Planet Junk. It's a clever name. And again, this is where Unicron, being this sort of omnipotent power, can tell Galvatron, because of course Galvatron assumes he's dead. He goes, well, he's not, because I've seen it. I haven't done anything about it, but no, he's not dead.
Yeah.
And tells him where they are. It's quite
Everyone gets everywhere very quickly. That's one thing about this film. In the TV series, you know, they'd crash landed on Earth and they were separated from Cybertron. In this film, they're to and from Cybertron, Junk, Unicron, everything, in a blink of an eye, which serves the storytelling purpose, but it's one of those things when you're younger, it's like, but they can't do that. How did they do that? But, you know what, I don't care.
In Hollywood, they've got wormholes. But
yeah, all that sort of stuff. Proper spaceships that go fast.
Now, the two sort of main groups have been separated. You've got Ultra Magnus and his lot have gone to the Junk Planet, whereas Hot Rod, Cub, the Dinobots have landed on, I didn't make a note of this one, they've gone to the planet with the weird justice system.
Yeah, so this is the planet of the Quintessons, which are new for this movie, which are weird five-faced aliens and their sort of subordinates. What I quite like about this is they take the main sort of hero cast and they split them up. And I started idly speculating that about whether this film actually was Lord of the Rings, where you take the Fellowship of the Ring and you end up sending them off in different directions with different missions. And I was trying desperately to figure out who would be who in Lord of the Rings, and failing mainly. Although I'm pretty sure Unicron is, he's both Mount Doom and Sauron and Saruman at the same time. And that makes the person that Cup and Hot Rod meet on the Quintesson planet, which is a little robot called Wheelie, that definitely makes Wheelie Gollum. The weird rhyming thing that tells them how to get places.
And if you're innocent, it means death. It doesn't matter.
So that's really weird. Again, it's pretty high concept, this, for a kids' film. They stick them on a planet where there's just this random, weird judicial system where everyone gets sentenced to death to be eaten by Sharkticons. It's just weird and creepy. But it's good.
Yeah. I mean, for a kid that's, again, you know, watching it as a youngster, I suppose, it's, you know, you can watch this and it could probably give you nightmares, you know, of being sentenced you know, you're innocent, and all of a sudden it's like, well, you're with all these sort of piranha-like sharks, and luckily our heroes manage to escape, and all very good timing. The Dinobots turn up, and I suppose with brute force manage to convince the remaining sharks to just attack their bosses instead.
Me Grimlock say execute them! I think the problems on this planet will be solved.
Yeah, it's a good sort of political motivator having giant robot dinosaurs crush you to death. It does make you want to reassess your priorities. And I like the way sort of it goes. I think as all these Sharkticons swarm up to take over and destroy their controlling people, one of the others says, I think the problems on this planet will soon be over. It's like, that's a very political thing to say. It's like, we've solved one problem, we don't see the outcome of it. I mean, it's not like anything like that's happening in politics at all.
Yeah, we've just rocked up on this planet and we've, all's going to go. I mean, this system of justice may have served the people well for thousands of years, but, you know, all it takes is Judd Nelson to turn up and ruins everything.
Well, he's such a bad boy.
On the other planet, Junk, where Eric Idle turns up for a paycheck, the Decepticons attack that, and the universal greeting eventually kicks in. But this is Ultra Magnus tries to open the Matrix because, in his eyes, this is their darkest hour.
Yeah,
and he's blown to bits. Ish.
Well, they actually, this is a point where they toned down some of the violence, apparently. So you can see, I think, on the DVD releases now, I think it's got storyboards for this. But so Ultra Magnus, who you've just adopted in the last 30 minutes as the new leader of the Autobots, and you've got to put your faith in him, and he's trying his best, gets blown to pieces. But what they were planning to do was have him quartered. Basically, Galvatron says to his troops, quarter him! And these ropes were supposed to come out, shoot around his arms and legs, and literally just pull him to pieces. And it's like, and they thought, that might be a bit too much. We might just have to pull that one back a little bit. So this terrifying medieval space torture.
Do it with an older character, not our new one.
Yeah.
I remember when I got Ultra Magnus, the toy, and I mean, it was, you know, it was great. It was handy as a storage device. You know, you could put your other Transformers on the back of him.
Yeah.
But he never, and I suppose that's the whole point, you know, he never strikes you as a leader.
No, it's just sort of big, solid, sturdy guy, and just doesn't have that sort of, I'd want to say sparkle then, but really we're talking about a toy. But I suppose that what I mean is, yeah, he's sort of a bit chunky and immobile, wasn't he, once he was transformed into a robot?
Yeah, he was just like a slightly different model of Optimus Prime, but, you know, I suppose that's the thing. On the outside he was, but on the inside he was nothing special really, I suppose.
Yeah.
So Eric Idle's people, Junk, whatever, they're like something like Mad Max. They have a nice little dance when they're all...
They talk TV.
They talk TV because that's how they learned. And they dance around the corpses of all their dead colleagues. It's a bit like, again, like the end of Return of the Jedi.
I never thought about the corpses, really, actually, in that instance, yeah.
I suppose most of the planet Junk probably is corpse, if we're talking about robots and stuff.
I say, if it's my funeral, what you can do is, and I'll put it on record now, if my funeral in the post-apocalyptic wasteland that will be Brexit is taking place somewhere where I'm just thrown on a heap somewhere, you're allowed to dance around it to a Weird Al Yankovic tune. That's allowed. In fact, I encourage it.
Do we get to choose, or does it have to be a certain song?
I'd like it to be Dare to be Stupid for, you know, okay, for linkages to this. But if not, you could have... what else could you have? You could dance around it too. There's a brilliant Weird Al song called Everything You Know Is Wrong, which isn't a parody one, I don't think. Well, it's sort of They Might Be Giants parody style, but it's absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, one of those two.
Or in the Star Wars theme, you could do the one he wrote about Episode 1.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's good as well.
Was that the one to the tune of American Pie, I think it was?
It is, yeah. Although I wouldn't really want the tune of American Pie at my funeral.
No. But I always said to my wife, if I went, I'd want to go like the end of Return of the Jedi, you know, on a funeral pyre. And of course, her point being far too realistic was, I don't think the London Borough of Sutton are going to give us a permit for that.
You'd have to go out to somewhere like, get her to launch you on Hyde Park Lake or something like that. Yeah, on the Serpentine or something.
Yeah, transportation would probably be a bit. I suppose it'd be like Weekend at Bernie's trying to get me on the tube up there.
You'd have to have someone with a load of kindling stuff down the trousers.
It's a lot of effort. Just do it in the back garden. No one will know. I'll be dead.
Yeah, put it in one of those incinerator bins.
Yeah, just stick me in a wheelie bin. At this point, now, they've got their mates, so they've all made friends with the junk people. This is when Unicron turns into the thing at the end of Spaceballs, a big maid. So he starts stamping on Cybertron and Galvatron. This is the point where he swallowed him. The junk's sort of corkscrew ship goes through his eye.
Yep.
And because Galvatron is already inside Unicron. Fucking hell, this sounds weird. and then Hot Rod is also in... This sounds like a totally different film.
The Hot Rod inside him.
Hot Rod is inside Unicron, and he fights Galvatron. And it's... This isn't... Again, I suppose maybe this is the point. But, you know, when you compare this fight to the Optimus Prime against Megatron one, you know, it's a totally different league. It's rubbish.
Yeah, it's not quite the thing, but I suppose it's just there too. This is the point of what you got, what I've decided to call hero puberty, which is something I think you've got in loads of films, isn't it, where your sort of young character suddenly has that moment where they have to become the man.
He's got the touch.
He's got the touch. He's got his first, you know, robo pubes, and the Matrix turns him into Rodimus Prime, so Judd Nelson puts on a slightly lower voice. You got the
touch! You got the power! Arise, Rodimus Prime. Optimus. Yeah! No.
It's a weird one because... then, as you said earlier, the power of the Matrix basically destroys Unicron from inside, and we've got the bit where the robots are being dangled over the pit of acid. You know, it's almost like the end of Toy Story 3, where the kid in the suit saves Dennis Quaid and Bumblebee, and they all manage to make out.
They don't make out. Yeah. That's a different different cut of the film.
That was Hot Rod inside Unicron. So Hot, yeah, and they've all made it out because Hot Rod has opened the Matrix. Fuck's sake, that sounds ridiculous. And yeah, he's Rodimus Prime, which sounds like really dodgy alternate to Amazon. And as you say, he becomes this. You know, he's had this coming of age moment. He's opened the medallion, and his sort of, I suppose, catchphrase is "Till all are one."
Till all are one. Yeah. Oh, come on! Doesn't make you swell with pride.
Bring back Optimus Prime. Well, they did.
They do eventually. Anyway. And that was another strange thing they did with Rodimus Prime in the main TV series, is they made him this really troubled leader who didn't really want to be a leader. And so you've got Galvatron on one side who's completely bonkers, and you've got Rodimus Prime on another who's like, oh, what am I doing? And so they bring back Optimus Prime eventually.
Because Galvatron, he's not killed. He's kind of thrown outside. He's thrown through Unicron, sort of into the depths of space. But, you know, he's still alive. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, this obviously sets up everything for Series 3. I mean, it's a bold, you know, again, going back, it's, you know, basically making a film to bridge between two series of a TV show. I mean, even they'd struggle to do that now with something like Game of Thrones.
What I like is, though, and I sometimes watch some of the TV series things because I don't have any children, so I don't have my time demanded upon to stop me watching cartoons when I want to.
When you do have kids, I end up watching a lot of Ben and Holly's Magic Kingdom, or whatever it's called, so yeah, maybe that's the new Transformers.
Well, possibly, but this film, anyway, I think just... One of the reasons it's rewatchable is it stands alone in its own sense, though. It doesn't matter that Galvatron doesn't die properly at the end. We see him thrown away, and the big baddie explodes, so you know it's finished. So it starts quickly, it ends, and the whole stuff in the between is great. Can I ask a question, though? Why do so many robots have moustaches? I love the designs.
Well, this is 2005, isn't it? I suppose, you know... Maybe that's what they thought the fashion would be back, well, then.
All the Junkions of moustaches, and Unicron's got a great big moustache.
Yeah, I mean, the junk ones in particular, some of them are really handsome. They're like sort of old Mongolian Empire type efforts, aren't they? They're really special.
Yeah, although Rekgar, the leader of the Junkians, does have rather prominent nipple guns for some reason, which I can't work out what their purpose is, really, because he turns into a motorbike and they don't turn into anything on the motorbike, so perhaps it's cold on Junkian.
It's nice to have this where you can sit down and watch it, and you know, maybe this says a lot about me, is that even though I watched the film and loved it, and you know, I went out especially and bought the Blu-ray for the podcast, you know, I don't have any massive urge to go and watch the TV show. I have more of an urge to raid my mum's garage and see if any of the old toys are there.
Yeah,
I don't know what I'd do with them now, just probably eBay them. It's good that, you know, I don't have, obviously I know that Optimus Prime came back, but it took me on an emotional roller coaster. Half an hour into a film and you've killed off your main hero and your main villain. Bloody bold.
It's very, very bold. I don't know, I just think it's brilliant. I invested so much in it at such an early age that it's never really worn off for me, and it is something I can return to happily over and over again. Because there was a whole bunch of those cartoons that meant a lot to you as a kid that got turned into something. I mean, the He-Man thing, the Masters of the Universe, which you've obviously done the podcast about, it's such a strange thing that they turned the cartoon into that it's almost unrelated to it, because the character designs are so different. And yeah, a lot of that was the problem of trying to achieve that in live action, whereas here they stuck to the same format and actually spent a bit of money on it. Not that I think they made the money back at all at the time.
It served a purpose as much as anything else. I guess, you know, Master of the Universe, you know, that was an attempt, and you know, it was covered on the Canon documentary, where, you know, again, this is just Canon trying to throw enough shit at a wall and hope some of it sticks. But, you know, you can imagine, and it's just as well. I mean, if they'd have made a live-action Transformers film in the mid-80s, it would have been dreadful. It would have been blokes in sort of tin outfits on. It would have looked like, well, you know, and even fast forward to, when did the first of these monstrosities come out?
I don't know, was it 2005 or something? Perhaps, coincidentally, the year of the Transformers the movie.
Yeah, it would have been around then, and at least the technology, and you know, obviously at that point, it was very, very amazing to see how they managed to do it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I remember, you know, all these various things, you know, the, was it Rock Lords? You know, I'm sure they did that. And
well, the GoBots movie was GoBots was Challenge of the Rock Lords, I think. Which I made a note of this. I remember seeing that. I never owned the video of that, but I remember seeing it at someone's birthday party or something. And that was one that was made very, very cheaply and was never going to get into cinemas. But that had the voices of Telly Savalas playing the main Rock Lord baddie. And that's just a robot that turns into a rock. And the main female character in that, which is another robot that turns into a rock, played by Margot Kidder.
Blimey.
So there's your Superman link.
So you've got Lois Lane and Kojak / Blofeld / whatever else.
Oh, Roddy McDowall in there as well, so you've got a bit of Planet of the Apes.
See, this is the stuff, I guess, you know, actors have still got to pay the bills and stuff, but you know, nowadays most of them would have at least some sort of cameo in a Marvel film or something. But, you know, I guess these cartoon films, you know, with the toy money behind them, they must have had, you know, they must have offered some decent wedge. I mean, if, you know, it's easy to look back now and think, oh, wow, how did they get Orson Welles? But if he's directing Hofmeister adverts, I'm sure.
Did you ever see those clips of Orson Welles doing the Paul Masson wine adverts? Where he's absolutely drunk. So he's on camera and he's supposed to be saying, the Californian champagne or whatever. And so it's just a series of outtakes. He's getting more and more drunk doing it. They're obviously not giving him prop wine.
Action, Orson, please.
You just do anything?
No, it's... Sorry, cut. Yeah, rolling.
102, take two.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne by Paul Masson.
And being Orson Welles, he probably insisted on the real thing. Oh, it's such a strange thing to watch. And there's also famously an outtake of him doing adverts for Bird's Eye frozen foods, where it's just an audio outtake. And it's just, what do they call it? They call it the fish tapes or something like that. Something daft like that. Because he's just shouting at the voice director. He's so, like, he's still like, do you know who I am? It's like, yeah, but you're doing Bird's Eye frozen peas, man.
You're selling fish fucking fingers, man.
Awesome,
Wells. Blimey. A whole rich tapestry. I'll dig some of these out and stick the YouTube links.
The Paul Masson one alone is just brilliant.
Well, that was Transformers the movie. I'm glad we finally got around to doing it because it was just such a treat to watch. I mean, if anyone gets a chance to get the Blu-ray, it's a really, really good one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
as you say, the animation's great, but the colours, they really come out. And I suppose, I don't know if they've. Did I read they've done a 4K one as well?
Yeah, I think the Blu-ray one is from a 4K remaster, so...
Oh, great.
It's very, very crisp. There's a lot of detail in there I never saw as a kid, because it would never have been there in the first place on the home video release, and certainly not after it had been watched every day, several times a day, for a year, 2 years, whatever.
And if anyone has a Betamax copy of it, I'd be interested to see how that looks. Not that I've got a Betamax player to play them on. But
just don't tell people that.
To spoil the dream. I bought a Superman 4 Betamax quite recently. And I did have the conversation with Mrs. Betamax saying, oh, right, so how are you going to watch that? that's for another story. I mean, the fact I've got it on DVD and Blu-ray and iTunes, but hey-ho. Anyway, Paul, let's get this rewound before we get charged a late fee. Now, you do a podcast of your own, which is all about Ed McBain.
It's about Ed McBain, the author, and more specifically, the 87th Precinct series of books, which was a series that was begun in 1956 and ended in 2005, basically when Ed McBain, Evan Hunter, his real name, when he died, and it's a police procedural series. And it's one of these things that perhaps in this country is less well known, but it's got a very dedicated and devoted following across the world, really. This is a guy who's sold 100 million books. He's a, you know, big deal. And it's basically we're doing a sequential read through and I'm doing lots and lots of research and finding out all the tidbits I can. And we're talking about the times in which the books were released, the sort of things that were going on in the world, in politics, music, sport, and generally being quite silly whilst talking about these amazing police procedural crime books. And they're called Hark, the 87th Precinct podcast.
Excellent. And where are you up to on that at the moment?
We've just reached book number 21, so we've reached 10 years into the series, 1966. And the next book we're looking at is from 1968, and it's called Fuzz, which was famously, a couple of years later, made into a film starring Burt Reynolds.
Oh, R.I.P.
Indeed.
And as we did discuss earlier on, this isn't the only Betamax podcast that you're down for, because, funny enough, we also plan to do UHF.
Oh, what an amazing film. I'm very much looking forward to that.
I've managed to get a copy. Now for that one didn't come out of the cinema, but this, well, certainly in this country, no. This one had a very special number one. Unfortunately, it wasn't The Touch by Stan Bush, but it was The Final Countdown by Europe, because this came out in December 1986, so that must have been just in time for Christmas and all those sexy new Galvatron and Scourge toys. Bloody hell.
Burning a hole in the pages of Argos.
Yeah, in fact, I'm sure there's a couple of Twitter accounts I've saw that have the old... pages of the Argos catalogue, so I wonder if they've got the Transformers from 86 and new on your shelves, it's Ultra Magnus. Yeah, me neither. Well, Paul, thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you.
An absolute pleasure, and I'll see you for UHF.
And I'll leave you with the universal greeting. Bar weep, grana, weep ninabong.
Yes. I'll try it and see if I can give an energy.
Make friends.
Treaty. They seem to have a ready supply of them, look like gum. Anyway, Paul, thank you very much.
Cheers.
I'll speak to you soon.
Take care.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West and Fergus Higginson and associate producer Chris Oakley. You can find out more by looking at patreon.com/Betamax Video Club.